there are very powerful dynamics around inequality and around access to things. And the language of access, the language of inclusion and exclusion, is very much framed in terms of the imagery of nationalism.
Hundreds of thousands of civilians are displaced. UN reports over 10,000 people have crossed the Palm Strait and they have sought refuge in India. According to UN reports, 220,000 people are recently displaced because of the clashes between the government and the rebels.
There was a certain pattern in which they were going around trying to hide or cover up the details of what was happening. For any of these commissions to come, you require the permission of the state.
We don't know why Canada is keeping silent like this, because Canada always respects the human rights and they know clearly what is going on. We don't know why they are being so biased or what is going on, what is the internal political motivation of them. We are very surprised over that. We don't want to lose any more civilians there, so this has to be stopped.
Good morning. This is Nisha Sajnani. I'm your co-host for this morning's edition of the South Asian Community News on CQUT 90.3 FM. Dr. Amita Handa is the radio host and producer of Masala Mix on 88.1 CKLN radio, which comes out of U of T and plays Saturdays from 4 to 6, and is also the resident DJ of the monthly Bollywood party Beshalam, which attracts over 700 people and growing. She is also the author of Silk Saris and Miniskirts, a book that explores cultural conflict among second-generation South Asian youth in Toronto. Here's a bit of what Dr. Amita has to say.
Everywhere I look, actually, it seems, any research done on Amita Handa comes right out with the beginning statement of saying what an incredibly exceptional woman you are. So I'm looking forward to meeting you. Let me start there.
Thank you.
Dr. Amita Handa is an exceptional woman, if I've not said so already, of seemingly endless talent and energy. She's also the author of Silk Saris and Miniskirts, South Asian Girls Walk the Tightrope of Culture, published in 2003. And Amita, do you currently still teach at University of Toronto?
I teach there part-time. I'm not teaching there this term, but hopefully next fall I'll be back there.
Terrific. I'm sure they're very lucky to have you.
Well, it's actually a great student body out there, too. Lots of South Asian students.
Well, let's start with the book, why don't we? The title of the book, let's start there, of Silk Saris and Miniskirts. I know you must get that question a lot, but do tell.
About the title?
Yeah.
Well, actually, it's funny. I did get interviewed on Metro Morning, and I was asked if I wore silk saris or miniskirts. And then I was continued to, like, the person who's interviewed and focusing on the saris or the miniskirts, I think they thought the book was about fashion, and then I had to sort of explain that's not what the whole book is about. But, yeah, I guess the title is just sort of speaks, I guess, in some ways to the dichotomy that a lot of, I think, second-generation South Asians feel growing up in Canada and sort of, I guess, being caught between or being seen as caught between or torn between two cultures. And so I'm just sort of talking, I guess, of the idea of silk saris, sort of the back home culture, the culture of your mother maybe, and the miniskirts, which is sort of more, I guess, popularly associated with mainstream Canadian culture.
Yeah, what I really appreciated about it, well, aside from the fact that I saw myself written into the pages, which was had to be a first in any of my academic, recreational, or other kinds of reading, and that was a pleasure, an absolute pleasure, was the way that you speak out against culture clash. And there's a sentence, actually, that rings in my mind, and I use it quite a bit, actually, in my own community organizing. The ways in which you speak about your own desire to identify all the things that limit or circumscribe or mute the totality of what we can express as second-generation South Asian Canadian girls and women. Could you name some of those factors that you feel might circumscribe the ways in which we live out our multiple and fluid identities today?
Well, I think, I mean, in some ways, even though the title is, you know, of Silk Saris and Miniskirts, which sort of very simplifies very much our experience, but it's really multi-layered. And I think when I was writing the book, actually, just as you sort of mentioned, being, you know, thank you for being able to identify with the book. There were so many people that I interviewed, young women, And in some ways, a lot of young women come up to me and they'll say, oh, thank you for writing this. But I actually felt the same way when I was writing it. I was so thankful to all the women who told their stories because through their stories, I was able to kind of not feel so alone in my experience. And I think a lot of what limits and circumscribes our experience is the way it's framed. I mean, we're very much, I think, as young South Asian women, we have to, in many ways, uphold sort of the reputation of our families and our communities, and there's a lot of pressure there in terms of what it means to be a good South Asian woman. And at the same time, there's also a lot of sort of pressure because of, I think, racism, and which in many ways is missed by a lot of the literature, which describes immigrant experiences as being caught between two cultures, but or culture clash, and sort of looks at peer pressure without sort of racializing that and realizing that peer pressure is very much racialized. And a lot of what I think a lot of us have experienced when we were growing up here was racism, and sometimes in that very sort of polite Canadian way. So I think that when, I think that really circumscribes us because we're either, you know, supposed to be, you know, Canadian or South Asian, and yet I think there's what we see is quite an interesting fusion of an identity that can't really easily be placed in either category.
Did you find, could you remember some of the examples that the girls may have spoke of about how they live that fusion?
I think there was a lot of interesting young women I spoke to. I remember, you know, one woman, and no one sort of fit any kind of typical stereotype, but I remember one woman spoke about really having a love of South Asian dance, and she was actually studying, you know, classical Indian dance, and in some ways very sort of traditional and very connected to the South Asian community. And later on, you know, she was sort of pressured by her parents to get married and engaged, and she ended up running away from home because her potential partner, wanted her to stop dancing. So that was sort of one story where, you know, that struck me. But what was interesting is she was also a very empowered person. It wasn't like, you know, your stereotypical, what I think a lot of people sort of see South Asian women as stereotypically passive and not empowered or not aware. I remember talking to another woman who was very interesting to me because her father was very religious, Sikh man, and she, you know, decided that she wanted to cut her hair, she wanted to cut her hair, and her father, you know, they were sort of against that, her family, and what she decided to do was just have some bangs, so she was able to keep the long hair, but have the bangs, and then she decided she wanted to wear black leather jacket, and she put the khanda, which is a Sikh symbol, on the back of her jacket because she wanted to also identify with her heritage. And her father actually saw this as very kind of, I guess, in some ways blasphemous, because, you know, it shouldn't be on the back of a symbol of a jacket. But in her own way, she was actually trying to assert her identity. And what was interesting about her is that she had this Punjabi accent, and I had asked her, you know, how old were you when you came to Canada? And she said, oh, no, you know, I've grown up here. And I said, well, obviously you've spent a lot of time in Punjab. And she said, no, I've never been to India. And I said, but you have this Punjabi accent. But then she explained that in her school there's like 88% Punjabi students, and then at home they speak Punjabi. So I thought, you know, that was a very remarkably very different experience than what I had when I was growing up. There's very few South Asians in the school.
Mm-hmm. That would be the same with my experience, not quite having the opportunities to integrate the signs and symbols of the experiences that I was being exposed to.
I just wanted to add that also, I think a lot of the ways in which I saw the fusion get played out, some of the sort of, I guess, more negative ways in which it comes out is that a lot of women do, you know, say that they feel very isolated, or they suffer from a lot of low self-esteem and depression. And I think a lot of that is because they're constantly feeling that they can't sort of please either set of expectations, neither the expectations of their parents and community, because they don't feel that they really sort of fit that neatly, nor the expectations of Canadian society or their Canadian peers. And so I found that one of the ways in which that was sort of major, in which they kind of negotiated that, was and that we all do in many ways, is as sort of through leading these double lives and kind of hiding certain parts of yourself either from one group or another. So in some ways, I guess lying or hiding, and I mean that was seems to be a really big coping mechanism in the way in which I think a lot of us sort of cope with these competing expectations, and at the same time try to, in some ways, have a sense of belonging and not feel totally socially ostracized. So I just wanted to add that, because I think that's quite major in terms of what I feel happens when you have to deal with lots of competing sets of expectations.
Cultural expectations and cultural shame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, lots of cultural shame. And it could be, you know, sometimes I think when they're with their white Canadian friends, they could be feeling ashamed because they're South Asian and they're not sort of white enough. And then when in the South Asian context, it could be feeling ashamed because they're not South Asian enough, you know, or they're not fitting that sort of authentic notion of what it means to be South Asian. So in some ways, I think what's happening with our generation is that that's being really sort of recreated and redefined, like what it means to be South Asian.
What it means to be South Asian. And that's what this show is about. We're going to keep exploring that theme and that question exactly. Something else that strikes me is mm-hmm. the little bit that I've been reading around your work in music. Mm-hmm. You know, as a DJ, as somebody who's... tell me about Masala Mix.
Oh, yes. That was it's a radio show that started about 15 years ago, and it was co-founded by myself and Vinita Srivastava. And we just actually... That kind of... stumbled upon that just almost by accident. We had a friend who was DJing in England, DJ Ritu. She's one of the first female DJs, and she's been doing it for about 20 years. And she came to Toronto and said, you know, you guys should start this here. At the time, there was a big sort of Asian music explosion in Britain. And so she took us to sort of what's known as Little India here in Toronto on Girard Street, and bought us 4 tapes. And she said, you know, this is sort of the in music right now in terms of Bhangra music. And so we decided to put in a proposal to CKLN for a half-hour show once a month, and we got this one-hour show every Saturday with only 4 tapes. So when we walked in there, we were really kind of nervous, because we're like, how are we going to fill 2 hours of that, you know, music with 4 tapes? And so that's kind of how we started off. And then it was just amazing the feedback we got. Like, there were so many people at that time that were remixing music in their basements, and they were trying to fuse, you know, the Eastern and Western sounds, and a lot of sort of DJs coming out of the woodwork, or people mixing music. So it seemed to become a really important platform for community and a lot of artists that weren't, you know, normally wouldn't be exposed on mainstream radio. And in terms of DJing, also started this night 2 years ago called Besharam. And it is mostly like a Bollywood Bhangra night, and it's really grown. I think it's probably because there's very few places you can go where you can just hear that kind of music. And so I do that once a month, and Besharam actually plays on in some ways some of the themes of the book as well, because it sort of it means shameless, and for people who are South Asian, it's a very in some ways derogatory term, especially for a woman to be Besharam, because it means she's not following the proper kind of, I guess, you know, conduct or codes of conduct around being a proper woman. And so we kind of wanted to take that term and turn it on its head and sort of talk about how in many ways it's used to regulate people's behavior, like sort of through gossip and just, I guess, a lot of judgment within the community, judging other people's conduct and behavior. But we wanted to also talk about what's really Basharam in the world, like what's really shameless in the world, such as, you know, world poverty and the war against terror that's going on right now and lots of other kind of issues which are actually more shameless to me than the other ways in which we use the term.
So outside of Basharam and the Masalabiks, are there other ways in which you continue to work towards disrupting these factors that limit and circumscribe the ways in which we understand ourselves, not only in our South Asian diaspora, but perhaps in across other diasporic communities?
I think that that sort of comes up every day, you know, in different ways. I am doing some work with Planned Parenthood right now around doing youth programming around sexual health education for newcomer youth. So I'm working in that. And then also just continuing to do some writing and you know, working with youth. But right now, a lot of my work has been around, recently anyways, around DJing and hoping to go back to teaching in the fall.
That's fantastic. We're going to be looking forward to watching and hearing from you. And we're going to get the chance to do that very soon in Montreal, I hear.
Yes, I'm really excited about coming up and speaking at Concordia. It'll be really exciting, I think, to connect with other people also, you know, I guess being challenged and thinking about these issues as well.
Amita Handa is going to be giving a lecture on the lives and struggles of South Asian teenage girls. That's not to be missed, and that's on Friday, November 24th from 2 to 4 p.m. in Concordia University in the conference room in H767. I'm going to be there, and I'm sure a lot of people I know will. Thank you so much, Amita, for taking the time to chat with us. And
great.
Wish you
thank
the best.
Thank you, Nisha.
All of your work in play.
You'll have to come on Masalamix so I can interview you next.
Nice. Can I find clips of Masalamix online?
Yes, you can listen to it live, actually.
Nice.
Every Saturday from 4 to 6 if you click onto CKLN.fm.
So that was Amita Handa, and you're listening to the South Asian News Collective on CKUT 90.3. Next, you'll be hearing an excerpt from a panel that was organized as part of Asian Heritage Month in Toronto in 2005. There are six panelists that are going to be talking about the term South Asian, and amongst these panelists are, of course, Dr. Amita Handa, who's the host of CKLN Radio's Masala Mix, and she will be joined by Srinivas Krishna, who's a filmmaker, Akash Maharaj, who was the former National Party Chair of the Liberal Party of Canada, Rima Kaur, who's a producer for Omni TV, Kulveer Singh Gill, who's the executive member of the Sikh Centennial Foundation, and Neeta Bawa, who's a radio host, activist, and counselor. Here we go.
I moved to Canada in 1996, and I had never heard of this term South Asian until I moved here, because I only identified myself as an Indian, and that's what I identify myself even today, as an Indian.
I would have to agree. I mean, I came in 1970 as a kid when I was 5 years old, and I frankly just want to be known as a Canadian, and everything else can come thereafter.
But that's what you want to be known, but that's what it is. I mean,
well, there's a huge difference between our desires and reality, isn't there?
And I think that's the key. A South Asian identity is an identity that is created by the perception of others from outside the community. But having said that, I do actually think of myself as a South Asian Canadian, as distinct from, for example, an Indo-Canadian or a Caribbean Canadian. I think everyone likes to be called as an individual,
yeah.
But there's no escaping the fact that in a multicultural society, people will always be seen as a member of a group. The question is, to which group do you choose to attach yourself within the Canadian mosaic? Mm. And I don't think South Asian is a bad label. I think that there is one thing on the negative side all South Asian have in common, that we all look brown to people who are not South Asian. But from a positive side, all South Asians are also descended from a common, albeit ancient, civilization.
Dr. Handa, you work with adolescent girls, and there is something called the global teenager. They want to belong to the world culture of being a kid. Do they identify as South Asians, the girls you work with?
I think some do and some don't. Some might identify with their individual ethnic identity, and some might identify with South Asian, but I'd have to agree that I think this is a term that's very interesting, because you're South Asian in Canada, you're Asian in England, you're Indian in Trinidad, and when I'm in India, I'm Canadian because suddenly I'm in a, you know, I'm not someone who's grown up there. But in some ways, I do identify with the term because it's a political term. So I think that in order to maybe organize or mobilize ourselves sometimes as a community, we need some kind of umbrella term to sort of come together as, but that doesn't mean we don't have individual differences.
I think there's a place for the South Asian term, but we need to be very careful not to apply it to all situations and all areas. I think there's a common thread that Akash referred to, that we do have a common thread, but it cannot be the one moniker that we use in all situations. In many cases, I'm a Canadian. In many cases, I'm a Sikh, a Punjabi, and in some cases, I'm a South Asian.
Rima?
I actually look forward to the day where we can be called Indians or Pakistani or Trinidadians. I find the word South Asian paints us with one broad stroke, and I think there's so much diversity amongst us. You know, even from a region perspective, a Bengali is very different from a Punjabi. A Gujarati is very different from a Malayali. And I think the mainstream needs to understand that a little bit more.
It's interesting that you say the mainstream. Going back, I guess, to what you said, Akash, people of color are going to, in fact, be the majority. Srinivas?
I think where South Asian becomes a very useful and an even necessary identity is not cultural, but political. You know, and in that regard, because one is seen to be of a group, whether one likes to or not, as much as I want to say I'm Canadian, as you pointed out, Akash, you know, you are seen to be South Asian, whether you like it or not, well, then you have to take on that identity on one level or another. You're forced to. And I say that place is not cultural, but political.
But I think that Canada is extremely well placed to adapt to this change. Canada has always been a multicultural society, albeit in the 19th century, multicultural meant Protestants and Catholics. Today, it means multi-ethnicity. But this really is, although at each generation has faced the opportunity to challenge what it means to be a multicultural and multi-ethnic society. And I think if you look at the basis of Canada, unlike old world countries, we weren't formed or called into being out of a common ethnicity or a common language or the determinism of geography or accents of history. We were created fundamentally 140 years ago as a political federation, as a country that was based on the idea that it would be possible to have a new kind of state where people are stronger together, not in spite of their differences, but precisely because of their differences.
What country are you talking about, by the way?
I think if you were to go back to the fathers of Confederation, they would be astounded and some of them would be horrified to see the lengths to which that celebration of differences has.
And that was an excerpt from CBC Radio. This is available online at cbc.ca if ever you want to go back to it. You're listening to the South Asian News Collective with Nisha and Liz. And we're going to go to, I think this is appropriate more or less, because it's the song is called How Am I? And it's done by Urban Turban Taza, which is a collective of different, I think, Indian and other alike. I'm saying Indian, I'm just generalizing. I'm sure there's a lot of different people from all over that have collaborated with this particular album, and it was supported by the Canadian Council of the Arts. So let's listen in to that.
ভাবছো তোমরা আমি কেমন আছি আমায় নিয়ে কানাকানি করছো মিচ্ছি মিচ্ছি চাই না আমায় নিয়ে তোমাদের দারুণ মাথা ব্যথা ভ্রান্ত ধারণা নিয়ে শুধুই কথার পর কথা একবারও কি ভাবছো তোমরা আমি কেমন আছি আমায় নিয়ে কানাকানি করছো মিচ্ছি মিচ্ছি চাই না আমায় নিয়ে তোমাদের দারুণ মাথা ব্যথা ভ্রান্ত ধারণা নিয়ে শুধুই কথার পর কথা সামনে পেলে আমায় বলা তোমায় ভালোবাসি চাই না আড়াল হলে আমায় নিয়ে করো হাসাহাসি ও চাই না সামনে পেলে আমায় বলা তোমায় ভালোবাসি চাই না আড়াল হলে আমায় নিয়ে করো হাসাহাসি চাই না ভালোবাসলে কাউকে আমি তোমরা ওঠো নেচে চাকে নিয়ে গল্প লিখে বাজারে দাও বেচে চাই না আমার ভালো চাইতে তোমাদের মিছে ব্যাকুলতা ভ্রান্ত ধারণা নিয়ে শুধুই কথার পর কথা চোখের সামনে দেখে অবিচার নিজকে আড়াল করো চাই না হতাশায় ডুবে গিয়ে ধ্বংসের পথ ধরো চাই না চোখের সামনে দেখে অবিচার নিজকে আড়াল করো চাই না হতাশায় ডুবে গিয়ে ধ্বংসের পথ ধরো চাই না জীবনের হিসেবে করো আমার মতো ভুল চাই না বেদনায় ভরে উঠুক জীবনের দুকুল চাই না আকাশ কুসুম স্বপ্ন দেখো আঁকো কল্প গাঁথা ভ্রান্ত ধারণা নিয়ে শুধুই কথার পর কথা দেশের রাজনীতির ধারক হবে তুমি ও চাই না তোমরা ভুলে যাও একেবারে তোমাদের জন্মভূমি চাই না প্রবাসে বসে দেশের রাজনীতির ধারক হবে তুমি চাই না বাজার কথা বলবে শুধু ফেব্রুয়ারি মাসে চাই না ডিসেম্বরে তোমাদের মনে দেশ প্রীতি ফিরে আসে চাই না তোমরা ভুলতে বসো নিছক মানবতা ভ্রান্ত ধারণা নিয়ে শুধুই কথার পর কথা একবারও কি ভাবছো তোমরা আমি কেমন আছি আমায় নিয়ে কানাকানি করছো মিচ্ছি মিচ্ছি চাই না আমায় নিয়ে তোমাদের দারুণ মাথা ব্যথা ভ্রান্ত ধারণা নিয়ে শুধুই কথার পর কথা.
You're listening to the South Asian Community News Collective on CKUT 90.3 Radio FM. Previously, you were listening to Urban Turban with the track How Am I, which is an important question to ask, along with Who Am I, Where Am I, What Am I? Coming up next, we'll be hearing an interview with New York City activist and organizer Biju Mathew. Biju is originally from Hyderabad, India. For the past decade, he's been an organizer with the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, which represents thousands of New York City's predominantly immigrant taxi drivers. He's also the author of Taxi, Cabs and Capitalism in New York City. As part of the Forum of Indian Leftists, or FOIL, which he helped to found in the early 1990s, Biju has been an active opponent of the Hindu right wing in North America, focusing on organizing against the funding of Hindutva groups. In the aftermath of the Gujarat genocide of 2002, Biju helped to form the Campaign to Stop Funding Hate. Here, Biju was interviewed at length by South Asian Community News Collective member Juggy. On today's show, we play an excerpt from that interview. Some of the topics addressed include globalization, migration and the rise of Hindutva amongst the South Asian diaspora, organizing against Hindutva from the destruction of the Babri Masjid Mosque in 1992 to the Gujarat genocide of 2002, the white imaginary of middle-class migrants to North America, and current campaigns to fight Hindutva.
Biju, I want to chat with you now about your work with the Campaign to Stop Funding Hate, your work against the funding of what's called Hindutva organizations in India, funded by individuals and groups in the West, particularly in North America. And one aspect of that work that interests me is the link that you make between the phenomena and the reality of neoliberal globalization and now how that has sort of put a lot of Indians in the diaspora in the embrace of Hindutva organizations, whether they know it or not. So could you speak to that particular aspect of this issue?
There are so many ways of coming at the relationship between neoliberalism and Hindutva or right-wing Hindu nationalism. But what I want to start by talking about is the migratory wave that produced the South Asian professional middle class in North America. it has a particular class and caste composition in its origin vis-a-vis India. What I mean by that is that India post 47, when it got independent, took on a certain, what I call a certain kind of narrow modernity, which is, you know, embracing a certain aspect of a technologized society, technocratic society, wherein it very rapidly industrialized, constructed large numbers of elite science and technology institutions, and the people who were able to access that were primarily the middle class and the upper class, and the upper caste. And it is that group of people who had begun to use those elite institutions that began the migratory wave in the late 60s when Kennedy opened up migration to the United States once again under conditions of Cold War paranoia. And why that demographic fact of the kind, the nature of the migration into North America is important precisely because of the what I call a particular relationship between Hindu nationalism and this particular segment of the Indian population. Hindu nationalism as an ideology is an ideology that fundamentally positions Hinduism as a particular variety of Hinduism, Brahmanic Hinduism, as I would call it, upper caste Hinduism, as I would call it, as the kind of base religion, as the natural religion of the people of India. And thereby, it does a whole series of things. It excludes any religion whose origin is outside of the Indian territorial boundaries of India. And the territorial boundaries of India, as understood by the Hindu nationalists, don't stop at the current territorial boundaries, but they include territories as far north as Afghanistan and as far east as Burma. And so it's this conception that this land was Hindu land, and the version of Hinduism that they ascribe to is Brahmanic or upper caste Hinduism. And in as much as the diasporic population that shows up in North America, in the United States particularly, is essentially brought up with that Hinduism as its base, as its kind of religion, as its understanding of Hinduism. Many of those who come from that class and caste background into North America, because of the specific nature of their experience, aren't even aware of anything else outside of that they can call Hinduism. Itself, if you look at any notion of Hinduism as a religion really didn't have a coherent identity till well into the colonial period. This is not to say that somehow the colonialists, the British, created a Hindu identity. That's not what I mean to say. It's a whole complex of factors, and it includes both the fact that the British began to use upper caste Brahmanic laws to kind of code the law of the land as a way of trying to remain neutral, thereby using the law of the people of the land itself as a way of governing them. And so the British began to reach out to essentially those who they saw as the educated elite, the upper caste Hindus, and began to build a whole framework for administration based on that relationship. In that sense, began to give something called a Hindu identity. But at the other end, as the nationalist movement progressed, one of the ways in which the nationalists themselves attempted to unify was, again, because many of the nationalist leaders early on were upper caste and Hindu, used a certain notion of Hindu and Hinduism to craft that identity. So in multiple ways, this a very coherent notion of Hinduism began to emerge only as late as, I would say, even the middle 1800s or the early 1900s. So it's from within this context that I want to talk about the fact that, you know, the people who are here, the people who are in North America, the middle-class professional Indian/Hindu community, has that natural kind of an allegiance to Hindu nationalism, and I want to take the risk of saying there's a particular way in which Hindu nationalism is more alive, is kind of more, let's say, virulent and rigorous here in the diaspora than even back at home. Because if I stand on a street corner, let's say in a city like Bombay, and stop the first 10 people who are going by me and ask them, you know, what they think about Hindutva or Hindu nationalism, I mean, I can be almost certain that I won't find more than one or two adherents to the ideology. Whereas if I stand, for instance, in Queens, in Jackson Heights, or in Oak Tree Road in New Jersey, which is the Indian hub, and stop the first 10 people that come by me, I'm sure I'll find the density of Hindutva adherents to be a lot more. And I think it's just the class caste composition. And so, in a certain sense, it is the kind of neoliberalizing world. It is the world of a particular kind of wherein a professional migrant began to move across national borders in particular ways. And, I mean, when we talk about globalization and neoliberalism, it's not simply all about capital mobility. It's also about particular ways in which national boundaries begin to collapse for certain categories of people. And the first set of people for which national boundaries began to collapse is for the professional middle class. I mean, we must realize that the Kennedy immigration laws date back to the late 60s, which is just a few years here or there before what the neoliberal moment, as we call it, with when the OPEC crisis and all of that unfolded and the kind of capital began to look to new ways to organize itself, right? So, I mean, this wave of migration is critical to, I mean, it's to understand both how, I mean, as the world began to be recrafted in terms of migratory processes in the 70s, how a particular class came to occupy power, both in North America in general, but United States particularly, because I think in Canada the experience is a little different. There are the nature of the migration has been different. There has been a lot more working class migration into Canada much earlier, with a longer history in a particular way, a little more continuous history, and into places like even Britain. Britain also had a significant working class migration, and these classes aren't that involved in this battle around Hindu nationalism. It's primarily middle class, upper caste formation that exists that is the home base for this ideology.
Biju, without oversimplifying things, in 1992 was when the Babri Masjid was destroyed by Hindu fascists in Ayodhya, and 2002 was the genocide in Gujarat under the administration of the Chief Minister Modi. And these two incidents, of course, I think mark sort of two important chapters in the history of Hindutva, modern day history of Hindutva, and the fight back against it. And in 1992, I think one of your responses with other comrades was to form FOIL, the Forum of Indian Leftists, to deal with this reality. And in 2002, in the aftermath of the genocide, the horrible genocide, you helped form the Campaign to Stop Funding Hate. So these two things sort of stand out, 1992 and 2002. I'm just wondering if you can reflect on that trajectory of struggle over that decade, right up until today, about how tangibly you and others have worked to confront Hindutva where you are in the United States.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, I think even as that battle continues, I think it's really, really important to reflect and strategize as to what is really possible and what is not, and to, you know, position one's resources in the appropriate places. I mean, Hindutva and its growth in the United States, of course, has a much longer history, as I just outlined a moment ago. But as you correctly said, in terms of an organized response, 1992 and the destruction of the Babri Masjid, the Babri Mosque in Uttar Pradesh in India, marked, let's say, the first moment when we began to get organized. Now, one of the things that began to happen with a lot of left liberal folks who began to organize against the presence of Hindutva here, it really came into place in some part because suddenly everybody was aware that Hindutva had done something quite dramatic back in India, but also that there were people in the United States, people with whom one shared professional lives, who were saying, oh, it was bound to happen. you know, or, you know, very sympathetic views being expressed quite openly in the United States. And so, in a certain sense, it was a reaction to that. The VHP of America, that's the World Hindu Council of America, which is a sister organization of one of the many units of the fascist outfit in India, the World Hindu Council itself, as it's called in India, here it's called the World Hindu Council of America, organized what could at best be characterized as a celebration in January 1993, called something called the World Vision 2000 Conference in D.C. And so it was in all of that context that we began to organize and finally kind of a network, what was then called the Forum of Indian Leftist FOIL, emerged on two planks. One was to counter Hindutva, and the other was to counter and do solidarity work around issues of neoliberalism. Now, FOIL emerged in 94, 95, and it did an enormous amount of work in the immediate period following by actually seeding a whole number of projects on the ground, amongst which, for instance, is a youth program called Youth Solidarity Summer, which is now in its 10th year of existence. It started out in 1996 and is now in its 10th year of existence. And it's been a really wonderful experience going through with Youth Solidarity Summer for so many years. I kind of highlight something like the formation of FOIL and then the coming of something like Youth Solidarity Summer because I want to point to two different aspects of the struggle. When I pointed to the middle class and the upper caste character of a large number of the professional migrants, back at home, for instance, in India, the base for the BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, or the Indian People's Party, which is the right-wing fascist formation's electoral front, grew very slowly through the 70s and the 80s. And the few parliamentary seats it used to win through till well into the 80s was primarily in urban India. Using votes of a certain sector of the population, upper caste and middle class, of course, but also from within there, a certain kind of a trader base. It had a significant trader base as its kind of base, and that pattern began to reflect itself here in North America. And our question, as we began to form FOIL, etc., was how do we counter this? And in a certain sense, the answer to it is that with this first generation migrant population of this particular caste and caste composition, the most important task actually is to draw certain defensive lines in terms of a language of an offensive strategy versus a defensive strategy. I think one of the things that we got very clear about early on was that given the density of the middle class, upper caste population in the United States, we felt that the most important thing was to draw a really quick defensive line and hold a certain line against this. Growing population of Hindutva adherents in the United States. And so we began to deploy that strategy. But at the other end, what was equally visible was that the children of these very people, the children of these very migrant first-generation, upper-caste, middle-caste, middle-class folks, were not necessarily that easily predisposed towards the fascist ideology. They were, of course, struggling with questions of identity, given the racism of North America, especially the United States. And in that context of fighting racism, etc., there was a particular way in which they might seek a Hindu identity, might seek certain particularized identities, but that didn't automatically make them open and necessarily adherents to Hindutva or religious nationalist ideology. And this gave us, for instance, the opening to set up something like Youth Solidarity Summer, because there the battle is an offensive battle. There the strategy is an offensive strategy, wherein you're trying to take the battle forward and build greater and greater degrees of understanding within the emerging South Asian youth population about the nature of Hindu nationalism. And I think on those fronts, if you come all the way to 2002, I think on those fronts you can see quite a remarkable degree of success. In as much as, for instance, I would say, of course, the campaign to stop funding hate remains part of that defensive strategy, wherein the fundamental idea is to draw certain lines and say, I mean, we will not let funding grow from out of these spaces. It's almost impossible to eliminate funding from places like North America or Canada, because, as I always say, a large amount of funding just leaves in the suitcases of people going back and forth. And therefore, it's almost impossible to stop that. But it is possible to eliminate, you know, rip off the mask of a secular identity that many of the Hindutva organizations wear in the United States. So, for instance, the Campaign to Stop Funding Hate's primary purpose in its first report was to look at this organization called the India Development and Relief Fund, which was effectively the front, the fundraising arm of the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, and the National Volunteers Corps, which is the parent body of the Hindutva organizations in India. And it was essentially a funding arm for them, but it positioned itself in the American multicultural framework as a secular organization and was skimming off funds from large foundations, claiming it was a third world development, whereas they were routing all that money straight to the coffers of the RSS. So in that sense, that the CSFH report, the Foreign Exchange of Hate, as we call the report, and which is available at www.stopfundinghate.org, marked, in a certain sense, the real clarity and the kind of coming together in really interesting ways of the defensive strategy. And what has happened at the other end with something like YSS, with more than around 300 young people who went through YSS, got involved in politics, came back, took YSS over in a certain sense, and ran YSS successfully for the last several years. I think we also saw the emergence of that youth and them coming onto their own. I mean, one of my best examples for that is, you know, every time we have a protest, counter-protest formation in New York, for instance, between Hindutva ideologues and us, those who, quote-unquote, kind of work within the broader structure of FOIL, YSS, etc., there's a very interesting mode in which it begins to happen now. We always outnumber them at this point on the streets. There are 40 or 50 of the Hindutva ideologues who show up for every protest, and most of them are 50-plus-year-old men, first-generation immigrants, and there are one or two women, mostly older, who are there in their pen, and at the other side of the road, we'll be chanting and shouting, and we'll probably be closer to 100-odd people or more, and a majority of us will be women, and a majority of us will be younger women, essentially second-generation women, who have, in a certain sense, taken the brunt of this kind of, you know, a kind of a neo-fascist traditionalism that has crept into the, quote-unquote, upper-caste Hindu household. So I think these are kind of some of the changes and some of the kind of impacts of a strategy that has kind of been willy-nilly unfolding for the last 10-odd years.
Biju, I just want to ask you maybe one or two more questions about this topic. There's a term that we use up here amongst Desis, amongst South Asians, which is model minority, and I'm sure you've heard that term as well.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
South Asians are often seen as a model minority, people who, in a very racist fashion, within this context, are seen as, you know, acceptable minorities, people who take on mm-hmm. certain professions, don't rock the boat, etc. And mm-hmm. it's interesting to me to draw the link between the caste and class origins of the people that fund Hindutva, as you mentioned, and this whole model minority phenomenon, because I think it's fair to say that the vast majority of people who sort of subscribe or are part of minority phenomena, engineers, doctors, lawyers, people accessing business, etc., aren't fascists, aren't necessarily actively involved. But there's sort of another aspect of this fascism sort of connects with this prevailing middle-class ethos that South Asians have here.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it's very frustrating organizing to deal with this. There's a line in a rap song by Mos Def and Talib Kweli Blackstar where they talk about sometimes it's your own people. And they're referring, of course, to African-American community, but I think that applies just as well to any community. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's your own people. And I'm just wondering if you have any reflections based on what I'm saying about how beyond the funding of hate, beyond the funding of out-and-out fascism, there still is, even when we deal with that and we confront that, there's so much more to deal with. And there's sort of this middle class, I hate to use the word fascism because maybe it's too extreme, but this middle class attitude that sort of prevents our communities from being mobilized and being effective. And I'm just wondering if you could share any reflections you might have on that.
Yeah, and I think, Jaggi, it's critical to go back to my notion of a defensive strategy versus an offensive forward-looking strategy. And I'll tell you why I'm saying that. I mean, I have always claimed that the middle class, upper caste migrant is white before they leave the shores of Bombay. You know, the imaginary which propels them towards North America is the white imaginary, in the sense that, you know, already embedded in their mind are, I mean, literally notions of a two-car garage suburban home. And so in that sense, one should not be surprised. I mean, it's the nature of the class character. And I think, the broader truth from which we need to depart there is to say that, with the exception of certain fragments and for particular reasons, in particular historical moments, the bourgeoisie always turns conservative on issues of national culture because it is trying to, locate itself within a particular notion of heritage, etc. And in the case of South Asian migrant, Indian migrant in this particular case, I think it's Frantz Fanon who said, I think the exact quote is something like, the Negro is comparison. And what Fanon meant by that was that the particular way in which those who are oppressed, those who are within the structure of, who find themselves in the bottom end of structures of oppression, constantly produce a structure of comparison. Constantly produce a certain way of locating themselves in relation to those above them and structuring themselves into patterns of mimicry, etc. And so we cannot talk about the modern minority structure, etc., without understanding that pattern of racism that produces them in a particular fashion. And it's almost like, you know, I would argue that it's for the South Asian American, oftentimes, it's one can even characterize it as a response to racism, wherein, you know, they have to put something out in this damn market, right? In the sense of when they present themselves as people within this particular labor market, who are themselves subject or objects of racism, they have to find a way to position themselves. And what better way to do it than to turn around and say, you know, America has no history. America has no culture. You know, it's such a new country, and there is nothing called white culture, really speaking. But we come from a land of really rich tradition and really rich culture, and are part of a huge tradition and heritage. Right? It's almost like you prop your history up as a commodity, as a way in which to position yourself. And I think it's those dynamics that begin to work in the context of racism. This is not to say that one condones it. This is to say that one understands the complexity of these phenomena. And once we understand the complexity of these phenomena, along with the broader characterization that I made earlier as to how the bourgeoisie turns socially conservative oftentimes, I think what we need to realize is that the battle against these any kind of social justice struggles, any kind of battles, even at the national level, around issues of conservatism versus liberalism versus progressivism, have to be fought and understood very differently, in as much as I think we need to build our bases in different places. We need to isolate certain segments of this middle class which have a greater propensity, for instance, to be more liberal from the other segments, etc. This is all part of what I'm calling my defensive strategy. For instance, in a space like New York, I think while the while organizing immigrant workers or immigrant labor, didn't necessarily begin out from the point of view of how do we fight battles within our community. Clearly, that is one of the effects that begins to have, because suddenly as the working classes begin to get more and more politicized and come into stronger and stronger political formations, the bourgeoisie has no choice but to recognize to some form of negotiation with you. I mean, in the case of Hindutva itself, I mean, while I have personally done a fair amount of work around issues of Hindutva also over the last several years, there's a particular way in which, as I begin to do that specific work in New York itself, the larger South Asian / Indian community in New York responds to that, understanding that, you know, here is somebody who's worked, for instance, with the working class population and actually built really, really effective links between Indians and Pakistanis, for instance. When India and Pakistan were on verge of a nuclear war after, on the issue of Kargil, the first public demonstration for peace was actually organized by the Taxi Workers Alliance. Everybody asked us, what are the workers' organization doing a demonstration about something that's going on 10,000 miles away? And our response was, this is exactly how our members feel, which is why we are out here. So I think, you know, we begin to position ourselves and we begin to work against these socially conservative forces that produce this modern minority thing. Of course, I mean, the battle there also, you know, it has to go to the fact as to, you know, all of these people who migrate to the middle class professionals, you know, the battle there, again, I think is something that can be, you know, done or won through a politicization of the younger generation at one end and the working class formations, because sooner than later, what this middle class needs to acknowledge is that they actually stand on the shoulders of the people who fought for civil rights in a place like the United States, the African American community, or and much later, the people who took on some of that, the earlier Latino communities, right? So I think it's just they have to be put in a political position wherein they'll have to begin to acknowledge it. It's not a matter of simple enlightenment that they'll come to realize it.
Okay, Biju, one last question on this topic. On the surface, seemingly the urgency of fighting Hindutva is less. On the surface, I say, because there's a new government in India, the Congress government, the Hindutva forces seem to be in disarray, if you believe the mainstream press. But certainly, if we are to know anything, is to know that the Hindutva forces are capable of organizing, and that is on the surface. And I'm just wondering, just as a final question on this topic, if you can talk to us about, tangibly, what does it mean now, living in North America, to organize against these forces? What are the ways in which we can organize? What is the challenge for South Asian organizers to confront this reality? What should we be doing?
There are several things that we can do here, and I'll come to that towards the end of my response. But, I mean, to begin with, I don't think we should... I take what you said about the surface very seriously. It is indeed very superficial, that kind of sense that things have quietened down. Absolutely not. I mean, when India went to its general elections in 2004 and the Congress coalition came to power, you know, yes, there was much celebration that Hindutva had been knocked out of government, which is true, and that was good, simply because it gave progressives who are fighting the battle ever since the Gujarat carnage of 2002 a space to fight from. It gave them a little bit more of a political space to fight from. But then, you know, there are several limitations to that. One, to begin with, one has to realize that the Congress itself is significantly infused with Hindutva, in the sense that there is a significant Hindutva lobby that's sitting inside the Congress itself. And so we should never, ever forget that. I mean, some of the early architects of Hindutva came through the Congress, and we should never at all forget that.
That was Biju Mathew, an organizer for the New York Taxi Workers Alliance and the Campaign to Stop Funding Hate. You're listening to the South Asian Community News Collective on CKUT Radio 90.3 FM, and you can tune in to us the first and third Monday of every month. I'd like to mention a couple of things. First of all, there's a there's an event tonight, something else to add to your already very full week. Tonight at 6:30 p.m. at the Cafeo Cafe on the corner of Rachel and Saint-Denis, there will be a conversation on Canadian multiculturalism that is a part of the University of the Streets Cafe series, and there we'll be able to continue this conversation on being and disrupting notions of being model minorities, visible minorities, dissenting majorities. I'll be your host this evening at Cafeo Cafe. Hope to see you there at 6:30. On our next show, which will be on December 4th here at the South Asian Community News Collective, we'll be doing a retrospective on the South Asian Women's Community Center. It's been advocating and organizing around the intimate and structural violence experienced by South Asian women and families for the last 25 years. So I hope you join us for that. If you'd like to get in touch with us, please email us at southasia@ckut.ca.
There are very powerful dynamics around inequality and around access to things. And the language of access, the language of inclusion and exclusion, is very much framed in terms of the imagery of nationalism.
Hundreds of thousands of civilians are displaced. UN reports over 10,000 people have crossed the Palm Strait and they have sought refuge in India. According to UN reports, 220,000 people are recently displaced because of the clashes between the government and the rebels.
There was a certain pattern in which they were going around trying to hide or cover up the details of what was happening. For any of these commissions to come, you require the permission of the state.
We don't know why Canada is keeping silent like this, because Canada always respects the human rights and they know clearly what is going on. We don't know why they are being so biased or what is going on, what is the internal political motivation of them. We are very surprised over that. We don't want to lose any more civilians there. So this has to be stopped.